Look, it's going to be like this. The idea of romance is a wonderful one. It's lovely. It's beautiful. But it doesn't just happen to people in their 20s. It just doesn't happen to people in their 30s. It's all ages. It can happen to anyone at any time. And I think it's important that we show that. As I am getting older, I am less and less inclined to want to write about younger people. But I like getting older.
Welcome to the Clunatics Podcast. I'm Kurt Graves. Today, we're going back in time to examine what queer literature looked like in its infancy, how that affected the people who read it, and how it's evolved to better represent queer people and educate allies. And to do that, we'll be talking to a few of the Clunatics' most distinguished members. Anyone who has been reading queer literature for more than a few years knows that many of the earliest gay stories depicted harsh consequences or tragic endings for its characters daring to express their love. Like, the only way you could write a gay love story was if the gays also got what was coming to them by the end of the book. And TJ is no exception. Here he is describing the first gay book he remembers reading. Do you remember the first queer book that you read?
Yes, The Front Runner by Patricia Neal Warren when I was 16 years old. And it is, I still think today, to this day, it's a landmark in queer literature. And I think it should be read by everyone. But at the same time, it is a book, you know, I'm going to be spoiling a 30, 40 year old book, but it is a book in which one of the main gay characters is killed. At the very end, he is an Olympic runner named Billy, and he is in the Olympics, and he's essentially assassinated because somebody who is extraordinarily homophobic does not think he should be in the Olympics and kills him.
TJ isn't the only one who remembers reading this book.
Well, hello, I am Brett Waters. I'm from Colorado Springs, Colorado. And the first book I ever read was Patricia Neal Warren's Front Runner. And I was in high school, and I just thought how scandalous this was and how delightful that I could read something that was my lifestyle. I didn't have to interject myself into somebody else's story, which I was so used to between music and television and books. But everything back then was always, it's like it always had to have a tragic ending.
I remember being 16 years old and reading the book up until that point and thinking, wow, these are characters that are just like me. They're not, they don't play out as stereotypes, but then you get to the ending and it's the most devastating. I think it's probably the most devastated I've ever been reading a book, aside from Where the Red Fern Grows, and it's just because I love dogs too much. That book affected me probably more than any other book I've read, just because I thought it was so well done, so well written.
Jay recalls a similar sense of tragedy in early books.
My name is Jay, and I'm from the New York City area. I definitely think that queer literature has evolved. I would say before the 80s, so many of the gay and homosexual characters were always portrayed as tragic, or they had to have a tragic ending, they had to die, they had to be abandoned. You know, there's always this kind of terrible things that happened to them, which was almost a subconscious, like, self-whipping.
John Brett remembers the first queer book he read, and unfortunately, it follows this trend.
So I'm John Brett. I'm from Lincolnshire in the United Kingdom. So I first read a book called I Want What I Want by an author called Jeff Brown, and it was published in the 60s, and it's about a trans person. A guy called Roy, who wants to become Wendy, and it's set in the north of England, not too far from where I live. It's pretty harrowing, pretty gritty. I started reading it again over the last few days, and so I found this book as a paperback in my partner's collection when we first got together. So we've been together 29 years now, and it would be about 28 years ago when I read it. And I think the hard copy is now up in our attic somewhere. And that was the first book I ever read. And it was an interesting book, but it was pretty gritty. And if I remember, it had quite a sad ending.
While it was immediately clear to me that Patricia Nell Warren was not a gay man writing about gay men, I was curious if the book that John references was written by a trans woman.
Well, this is quite an interesting thing to ask, because I've done a little research over the last few days to find out about this guy. He passed away in 2008, but I read a blog by a trans woman from Canada who tracked him down because she had a first edition copy that she wanted signing. And as far as we can tell, as far as she was able to find out, he was cisgendered, heterosexual, married. But the book is so detailed that there is a question that maybe he might have wanted to be trans and just couldn't be. It's very detailed. It goes into details about tucking everything up and strapping everything up so that he could wear panties. The main character could wear panties. Talks about, the fact that the main character knew that there were people in the world who had surgery to change gender or to change sex, as the word term was then. So, yeah, it's an interesting thing how much the author knew, whether it was research just to write the book or whether it was actually, a deep longing that never got fulfilled.
The concept of writing what you know from a place of personal experience is part of a movement called Own Voices. We'll be diving into that in more detail in a future episode. In the meantime, there was one book series that came up again and again in discussing early queer literature.
The very first book I read was Tales of the City, Thomas Ed Morpin. And I adored it.
I was talking yesterday with another clunatic who brought up Tales of the City by Armistead Maupin.
I did read.
I go back to the original Tales of the City, the miniseries, and was addicted to that.
I've read all of the Tales of the City series because you can't not.
The first book from that series, also titled Tales of the City, was published in 1978. The first two voices you heard there are Janice and Linda, and I'm going to let Janice describe what the general attitude was toward the LGBTQ community in her town at the time those books were released.
Hi everyone, I'm Janice Burney, and I'm in a blanket fort right now in Melbourne, Australia. Okay, so way back in 1978, understanding my age, I grew up in a small town of 11,000 people. Tiny library, very sensitive. Had never seen any kind of queer literature. Nobody was out in the town that size. You just couldn't be. It would have been horrendous for them. So I ran away from that place, came to Melbourne and went to uni and met people of all different sexualities. And even though in the 70s they weren't really out, a lot of people weren't out. It was still a very difficult time. People were being arrested. There were some pretty horrific things happening between the police and the community. So to be out was a real act of courage.
Both Janice and Linda were allies from an early age, befriending those courageous queer people in real life, not just on the page. Linda tells us more about her background.
My name is Linda Pierce. I'm from Spokane, Washington. I've always had queer people in my life. My best friend in college was gay. And I was like one of the first people he came out to when we were freshmen in college. And so that was probably the first person I know. My best friend in high school is gay. She came out and met her wife, gosh, when we were seniors in college. And then actually the library world has a number of people that are gay in it. That seems to be a safe place and a good place for that. So many of my colleagues have been gay. So that experience has been part of my life for a long, long time.
Janice goes on to describe why Armistead Maupin's books were important to her.
Then, of course, AIDS happened, and his books reflected that. And in my life in Melbourne, it was happening around me too. So I was very much, that's when I started to really, I would say, become an ally. One of our very good friends from uni was president of the Victorian AIDS Council, and they were pushing for funding, and it was just early 80s, horrible time. But the community came together, the safest group. Everybody kept saying the safest group are the lesbians, but of course they were wonderful, and they joined forces with the gay community. And I think in Australia anyway, I think that's when we really began to see them coming to the fore, to saying, we want our rights, we're here, we're queer, get used to it. That was the thing. And from then on, it was just, it led to what we've got now, which is, marriage equality and so on. The real journey with the fighting was in the 70s. I was part of that. I saw it, and that's when I became an ally.
You know, we have a lot of history, and we have a lot to thank the older members of our community for. And, I'm starting to feel a little bit that way myself, because I'm about to turn 50 in a few weeks. And realizing that I am part of that kind of age group now that is seen as older. And then I've got my partner who's 81 and who grew up in the 40s and 50s and saw a very different side to queer life than I did. And that's, I think sometimes, and I don't want to sound like I'm bashing on the younger generation, but I think some of our younger generations have kind of lost the connection a little bit to the history and what came before and the voices that spoke out so that they could have the life that they have now.
We're fortunate now to live in a time where queer literature doesn't have to be defined by the bad things that happen to the protagonists, but a few of the tropes from earlier generations persist. Here's Jay again.
The stereotypes, are they still there? I guess they are in some ways. When you read really MM romance, it tends to be a little bit more enlightened, I guess you could say. Though there's still some tropes that kind of keep going on. The feminine guys and, they like to go shopping. Some of that kind of stereotypical characterizations.
And if it's not a stereotype rearing its head, it may just be inauthentic writing.
I understand that romance is a fantasy. I get that. I do. But not everybody needs to have an 8-pack abd and a 12-inch dick and growl wherever they go and have their name be like Blaze or Steel or something like that.
I'm hoping that I'm not going to say something bizarre. One of the things that really irritates me is what certain writers will use words that I'm like, wow, I don't ever remember telling another man that I like the perineum.
But queer literature has come a long way, particularly male-male romance.
And that's part of the reason that I really liked to read, or started to read and really enjoy MM literature, because I felt like it was about me, or I could be in that situation. And for so long I've been reading so much that I wasn't. It was just reading it and then being an observer of the story instead, where I couldn't quite put myself in it without changing pronouns and doing that. That's one of the appeals, especially I liked, to MM romance. And there's been some books that I've read that have made me think differently about how I see myself, how I see other gay men and other people. So it has been good and a learning experience for myself.
And we can't talk about romance without talking about sex. It's woven into the DNA of romance. Chris helped me make a connection between the work I do now and the books I remember seeing on grocery store shelves when I was a kid.
Hi, I'm Chris Gray.
And where are you from, Chris?
Rockford, Illinois. Raised here, have lived here all my life. Before, I always kind of read strictly male-female romance, whether it was contemporary or historical, the bodice ripping,
Oh, yeah. Well, the only reason we don't call these bodice ripping is because men don't wear bodices. Otherwise, I'm sure they'd be getting ripped off. And I shouldn't say they don't, because I'm sure there's books out there where they do.
Yeah.
And all that gender-neutral undergarment-ripping content, it too can be problematic. FYI, John mentions a specific author's name in this next bit that I'm going to bleep out, because it's really not important to the context of our conversation.
And I also discovered the work of another author, but most of her work was sex, 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 which was fine, but it was literally every scene was sex, sex, sex. I kind of got bored with that. Those genres have their place.
Oh, I think it's incredibly important, because in some ways it's almost easier for, you know, het cis people to accept the gay man as caretaker, as father, as, you know, as business person, as lover, as partner. But like the second they get to the sex part, then it's icky again, mm-hmm. you know? So when we talk about, other writers really focusing a lot on the sex, like, I don't say that disparagingly at all,
because no,
I think getting people used to the sex part is really the last great hurdle, that like, you got to get over the sex part. If you, and also stop thinking about what it's like when we all have sex. So, and I don't mean gay men, I mean everybody. Let's all stop worrying about what it's like when we have sex or what the mechanics are, but like, get past that hurdle. I think the romance that leans more towards erotica is also very important in its own way.
Yes. I do. I just got, I got tired at one point of reading book after book that was filled with it.
Mm-hmm.
But you're right, getting used to the idea of sexuality and two men, two women, whatever, being sexual is something that the rest of the world needs to kind of just deal with.
So how has queer literature evolved? TJ shares some of his thoughts on his own evolution.
Fiction still has power. Romance is the biggest moneymaker in fiction. Romance is. People don't like to admit that. You know, you have the literati that will raise their nose at whatever, but romance makes more money than any other genre. And for a reason, because people like the escapism, people like the fantasy. But I've always wrestled with the idea of what I am contributing to that particular genre as a whole, the umbrella term of romance, because I'm guilty. I will say that I'm guilty of some of the same sins that I'm trying to speak out against. I mean, of course, you know, you when you're writing romance, you do tend to have imperfect people, yes, but they all are handsome and beautiful people, and they always have the right thing to say, and that's something that I'm guilty of as well. But I'm trying as I move forward and as I get older, step away from that. I want more realistic people. I've always said that I want to write how I think people talk, but I also need to start taking into consideration that I also need to write how everybody looks and acts and things like that. Not everybody is a white straight guy who suddenly has, I have these gay for you feelings now that I've never, ever even considered before. And now we're all going to just go have sex for the first time, and I'm going to take it like a champ, because that's how gay sex works.
TJ has already embraced all kinds of characters, those who break the very molds he's talking about here.
So as an adult reading TJ's books, I just thought, well, after reading the first and then the second, and of course even at the beginning, in there I'm a kid, there were just diverse ages and types. But each book I read, I thought, this is fantastic. I'm so sick of fetishizing gay men. I see it in some author groups, and that's, you know, I try not to judge, and that's their business. But I want to read about normal people, real people, and real people come in all shapes and sizes and have all different personalities.
And that was something that why I adore T.J. Klune's book. I my whole life has been interjecting myself into scenarios to feel normal. And that with TJ's books, there are so many. I mean, come on, Linus. we've got an overweight man with a spare tire and this tall, skinny, I'm older men too. I really get so tired of this. Everything gets geared towards these young people, and every character is these young hotties, and yes, it's great and wonderful thing. But even as my life has evolved through the years, especially as a gay man, not being able to come out, and when I did finally come out, it was because I just didn't care anymore what people thought. And it's like, get over yourself. But TJ has brought this world and taken the absolute gorgeous hunks and created these people like Paul Austere and Vince and Nana and, oh, please, Johnny Depp. and Joe and Ox and, oh, my God. I mean, I just feel like it's sunshine every time. It is literally a breath of fresh air to open one of his books and read. And I have never in my life read a book twice. I have read his book 2-3 times and still get something new out of it.
I love the fact that he includes characters from across the spectrum and also across age ranges. I think it's something that's kind of unique to TJ. Olive Juice is one of those where the older, more mature characters, I think they're in their late 40s, if I'm right, maybe, those characters. But also my favourite is John and Jackie. That's a story that broke my heart. But also, in that short story, TJ painted a whole life of a couple sharing their life together and coming to the end of their life. And it was such a wonderful way that he did that. And I don't read across a great deal of authors in queer literature, but you don't seem to find very many that are working with writing older characters.
Just because they're old doesn't mean they're not interesting, you know?
When it comes to TJ and writing older characters, Linda noticed a trend that I wanted to bring up with TJ when I spoke to him.
And I think what's interesting to me is that some of the older male characters resonate more with me because I think that they are more, in a way, nurturing than some of the older female characters. Some of the older female characters, like you talk about Nana and We Three Queens and those types of things, the female characters are wonderful and they're well written, but they almost seem to be there for almost, and I don't want to take this too far, for more comic relief than for emotional support.
You are? Nana gasped. I didn't know that. Huh. Psych, you guys thought I had dementia. Classic.
And so I don't know if that's just me reflecting it or that's intentional on his part or just how the characters are developed and how they interrelate.
One of the things that one of the interview subjects I talked to said when we were talking about the older characters is she noted that she saw a trend that the older female characters were a bit more comic, where, mm-hmm. and the older male characters were a bit more involved.
Okay.
Which, one, I wonder, like, have you thought about that? Was that intentional? Do you think there's
yes.
truth to that? And two, if there's truth to that, you know, was there some intention in almost flipping the script that you would, you know, you think of older female characters as like the mother or the crone, and now it seems like almost the men are taking on the role of like the more compassionate, more involved.
Well, it was intentional to an extent. I knew that when I write older characters, older female characters, I want to avoid having to them always have to be the role of the matronly saint. I get that has a place, and that is, you know, there are some great characters that are like that, but that's not what I wanted here. I wanted them to, like We Three Queens, Nana, Mrs. Paquin, I want them to have their moments of comedy to show that not everything has to be all serious and dour all the time, especially when it comes to women. They can kick back, they can have fun, they can do whatever, they can say whatever the hell they want, just the same as the rest of us. But on the flip side of that, I will admit that with the idea of older male characters getting more involved is probably stems from the fact that I myself am a man, and that is just how I see it, and that's how I would write it, and probably stems from the fact that I most likely have unresolved daddy issues myself. So
one of the things that I took away from my conversations with Janice, Chris, Linda, Jay, Brett, and John was that queer literature is no longer a place in which the worst versions of gay stereotypes are played out, or where queer characters pay a price for just living authentically. No one is getting murdered for being a gay athlete. No one is being taught a lesson by a bigoted straight dude with a gun. Instead, the lessons are being learned by readers. Queer books are a place, even for queer people and their allies, to learn more about the queer community.
Okay, so I'm going to place the first book I read, which is I Want What I Want, at the beginning of the spectrum, and I'm going to place at the end of the spectrum Why We Fight. Two books about trans or non-binary characters, entirely different in how they are written and how they feel what they represent. So in the first book, we've got a very harsh story about the main character wanting to be a woman and being in a situation where he's sent to a psychiatric hospital, and then he comes out of the psychiatric hospital and he continues to dress up in private, gets found out by his father, gets beaten. It's really, you know, harrowing. Then you've got Why We Fight, which puts forward the struggles, but also is celebratory. It's telling a story and telling how difficult things are still and how much more there is still to go. But there, in that book, there are a whole range of characters from the Tell Me It's Real series. But they're just polar opposites in a way.
Other than, I think as time has evolved, they've really brought up more into the real world and real world problems versus just being a true fiction, you know, with a fictional town or city or, you know. So, I mean, you've got human problems that everyone can relate to versus just making it so sugar-coated, that, you know.
And I throw his books out, especially How to Be a Normal Person. That one's particularly special to me. I adore that book. That was the beginning of my journey in learning so much more about asexuality, yes, and demisexuality, and so much more. I had a limited vocabulary prior to reading, particularly TJ's books. His representation is brilliant, and so you get to learn about these things.
My God, I've had to learn so much with him. I never knew what an asexual was. Yay for How to Be a Normal Person. Which, that was another book that last year I had read with this little group, and it caused so much talk. We sat in my chat room on Skype, just discussing how none of us, never understood what this asexualism meant. And that book shines so much light, and then also gave us a huge amount of topic. And then also with Bear Otter and the Kid, when we start getting these cross lines, when a character like Corey/Corey comes into the mix. So now we're dealing with this gender fluidness that none of us understood. And it was so great to be able to just sit and discuss this with each other and realize how much people are changing and accepting each other more and more because of somebody like him.
Queer literature has come a long way. So far that I was able to walk into my local Barnes & Noble and buy TJ's latest book, A Queer Story by a Queer Author. and we'll be celebrating more diversity in TJ's writing in the coming episodes. But there's also a long way to go before we can say our work as advocates and allies is done. I'll let TJ have the last word.
Well, obviously, at this point, we're not always the stereotypical side characters who are either there to be overtly flamboyant or to get sick and die or to be beaten because we're queer. That still happens in 2020. That still happens. And, you know, whatever, it is what it is. But we've moved a lot farther away from the days of barrier gaze. And though it still happens in all forms of media, obviously we're still fighting to be included in stuff like the Marvel movies and Star Wars, where they can say, here's your representation, and it's a 2-second kiss, and we're being fed scraps and told it's a full meal, and we're being told to love it. And we don't have to. Obviously we shouldn't, because that's bullshit. But when it comes to literature, it's advanced a lot more, especially in YA. YA is at the forefront of diversity, and that's wonderful. I wish that we saw that more in adult literature. We need queer people telling queer stories. We need people of color telling their stories. We have to have own voices, because own voices matter now more than ever.
Clunatics podcast is produced by Susanna Frigo, Louis Garcia, Angela Nolmone, Cedar Rajasingham, Mia Skiberis, John Steiger, and me. This episode was written by John Steiger. Make sure you're following the Clunatics podcast on social media. Join our Facebook group and find us on Instagram and Twitter using @ClunaticsPod. Special thanks to Michael Leslie for sharing audio of Until You by TJ Clune. If you like what you heard, please take a moment to rate and review the podcast on Apple Podcasts or wherever you're listening to this episode. We'd also love it if you told a friend. We know that there is a lot of financial uncertainty in the world right now, and we want you to know that the Clunatics podcast will always be free to enjoy. Thank you so much to all of the Clunatics who have already donated to support the podcast, and we have some really great news. We've secured a season sponsor for the first 20 episodes of the Clunatics podcast, so anything that you donate between now and July 1st will go directly to the Trevor Project. If you'd like to make a donation, you can hit the donate button at clunaticspodcast.com. Additional information about the podcast, including episode transcripts and the Clune speak, Don't Be a Dictionary, is also available at clunaticspodcast.com. You can find out more about me and my work at kurtreads.com. That's kirtreads.com. All music and sound effects heard in this episode are licensed by Storyblocks Audio.